Happy to help and wish I could help more. If I had my way, you'd be with us a couple more days at least, maybe more. I'd just as soon leave. I am sure you would. No one wants to stay, and who can blame them? All the excitement, the resurrection and all. But the potentate has called a meeting of directors and above his office at 2200 hours. You are expected.
I am?
When his office was told you had succumbed to the heat and had been injured and operated on, we were informed that if you were alive and ambulatory, you were to be there.
I see. I'm glad someone does.
You, sir, should be a patient. I wouldn't be running around so soon. I was told this was superficial, minor surgery.
Minor surgery is an operation on someone else. You've heard that, I'm sure. You know a nurse did the procedure. And good as she was pressed into duty. Do you know who that was?
I'm pretty sure she was Native Hannah Pale Moon, she said. I wonder if she's got my phone. It was in my...
I doubt it, Director. You'll find your wallet and your keys and ID unmolested. We know better than to confiscate things from someone at your level.
I appreciate that, but no one took your phone, sir. Could you have dropped it where you fell? Left it in your vehicle?
David cocked his head. Possible, but unlikely. He had not been talking on the phone when he fell, best he could remember, so it would have been in his pocket.
Where would I find Nurse Pale? I told you, Director, she would not have your phone, and I'm not going to tell you where she is.
We're working 24 on and 24 off here, and she's off. If she's like me, she sleeps the first 12 of those 24 hours off, and she ought to be allowed to.
David nodded, but he couldn't wait to get back to his computer and look her up in the personnel directory.
Ma'am, I have to find an employee I'm worried about. Name's Annie Christopher, cargo chief of the Phoenix, but assigned crowd control at Sector 53 today.
That's not good.
So I've heard.
Lightning there?
Bad. Several deaths and injuries.
I can check to see if she's in our system. You might check the morgue.
David flinched.
I'd appreciate it if you'd check your system.
I will, sir.
Then you had better get to your quarters and relax before your meeting. You know as well as I do, you're in no condition to be sitting at a table, thrilling as it may be, to meet with a man who is dead this morning and is alive tonight. Follow me.
She led him to the nurse's station where she searched the computer.
No, Christopher, she said. But our entries have been hopelessly delayed.
She would have had an employee badge, David said,
and it should have been swiped by a wand.
So the morgue, he said, again trying to cover his emotion.
Look on the bright side, she said. Maybe she wasn't a victim at all.
That would almost be worse, David decided. Why could he not reach her, and why would she not have tried to reach him?
Well, maybe she had. He had to find his phone before the meeting.
Nothing, Rayford said. David hasn't accessed his computer for hours, and I'm getting no answer on his phone. Now it's not even letting me leave a message, as if he's turned it off.
Strange, Albie said.
So Pueblo doesn't even know we're coming.
And we're not going if we don't know where it is.
We'll find out.
You're a resourceful guy, Albie, but I love the impossible.
But you're the boss. I need your permission.
What's your plan?
To find out if your new look and ID work.
Oh, boy.
Come on, man, confidence.
The plan, Albie.
I'll be the ranking officer down there. I blame the computer delay on all the excitement or the incompetence in New Babylon. Who can argue that?
You're with me. If they demand ID, you've got it.
You're no longer just a civilian helping out, though. You're a recruit, a trainee.
Uh-huh.
Not only do I insist on a car, but I'll get out of them the location of the bunker.
This I've got to see.
I love showing off.
Rayford slapped Albie's computer shut.
Tell me about it.
Kenny Bruce tried to tug Buck toward the barrier, as if knowing his dad could get him past it. But Buck was anchored to the bed. He felt as if he'd survived a plane crash, or hadn't. It was as if his spine were compacted, every muscle, bone, joint, and tendon tender. He sat there trying to muster the strength to rise and stretch and make his way to his wife and the others.
Kenny, apparently resigned to patience, climbed onto his father's lap and put a hand on each side of his face. He looked into Buck's eyes and said,
Mama?
We'll see Mama in a minute, hon, Buck said. Kenny traced Buck's deep facial scars with his stubby fingers.
They don't bother you, do they, bud?
Dada, Kenny said. Mama.
Presently Buck rose, lifting Kenny as he went. The boy spread his legs and settled in over Buck's hip, his arms around him, head on Buck's chest.
Wish I could take you with me everywhere I go, Buck said, limping, stiff-legged and gimpy.
Mama, Dada.
Yep, we're going, bud. Buck prepared himself for the always embarrassing welcome, save for the last person to rise, but when he came into view of everyone else in the safe house, he was virtually ignored. Leah sat bundled in a robe, her red hair wrapped in a towel, leaning back against a wall, dozing. Chaim stared at the tabletop before him, his head in his hands, a straw in his coffee cup. Tian stood beside a window, out of view from the outside, just in case, head bowed, softly praying. Chloe paced, phone pressed to her ear, tears streaming. She looked directly into Buck's eyes, as if to let him know she was aware he was there, and when Kenny tried to wriggle down to get to her, Buck whispered, "Stay with Daddy a minute, huh?" Chloe was saying, "I understand, Zeke. I know, sweetie, I know. God knows. It'll be all right. We'll come get you, don't you worry. Zeke, God knows. It'll be after dark, but you stay strong, hear?" She finally rang off and everyone looked to her. "Big Zeke was busted," she said. "Zeke Sr.?" Sion asked. Zeke Jr. was much bigger than his father, but still they were known as Big Zeke and Little Zeke. She nodded. "GC goons got him this morning, cuffed him, charged him with subversion, took him away." "How'd they miss Zeke Jr.?" Buck asked, finally letting Kenny down.
"Zeke," Kenny said, giggling.
Chloe shrugged. "Their underground was better hidden than ours, and I don't think Little Zeke ever showed his face outside."
"Zeke,"
Kenny said. "Little Zeke coming here," Leah said. "Where else would he go? He says GC is staking out the place, picking up people who stop for gas." "How's he know?" "He's got some kind of a monitor rigged up that he used to keep track of his dad. That's how he knew Big Zeke had been arrested. He knows his dad won't give him up, but he also knows he can't stay there. He's packing." "Yeah," Buck said. "All he'd need is for the GC to find all his files and document-making paraphernalia."
"It will be good to have him here," Tsion said. "He will be safe and can do so much for so many. Buck, how are you feeling?"
"Better than Chaim, apparently." The old man lifted his head and tried to smile.
"I'll be okay," he mouthed through his clenched jaw. "No capers for me. Eager to study and learn."
Tsion moved away from the window.
"And me with a student who cannot talk. You must listen and read. You will be an expert about our own people before you know it. God's chosen people. What a thrill to teach it. I will use the same material in my cyber lesson, wherein I expose Carpathia as the Antichrist."
"Coming right out with it, are you?" Buck said.
"Absolutely," the rabbi said. "The gloves are off, as you Americans so like to say.
There is no longer any question about him, nor should there be. I am persuaded that Leon is his false prophet, and I will say that too. Those who have ears will not be deceived. It will not be long before the Satan indwelt beast will take out his rage against the Jews."
Chaim held up a hand. Buck could barely make out the labored, muffled question.
"And what are we to do? We are no match for him."
"You will see, my friend," Tsion said. "You will learn today not only the history of the Jews, but their future as well. God will protect his people, now and forevermore."
"I like being a believer already," Chaim managed.
"Buck," Chloe said, stepping close to embrace him, "we have to plan Zeke's rescue."
"Just what I need today, another mission."
"You slept, didn't you?"
"Like a dead man."
"Don't say that."
"Well,
it's you or me, pal," Chloe said. "If you need another day of recoup, I'll be ready," Buck said.
"I can help," Leah said. "I'm fit."
"Maybe the two of you, then," Chloe said. "I've got to get news to the co-op. Keep everybody working together."
"We're going to need a pilot," Buck said. "Put the GC chopper down right in the middle of their stakeout, chide him for missing a suspect, and we arrest Zeke Jr. and bring him here."
"What? What's with all the looks?"
"We don't have a chopper today or tonight, hon," Chloe said. "Probably not until tomorrow night. And we don't dare risk making Zeke wait that long."
"Okay, so where's the helicopter, and your dad, and Albie?"
Chapter 4. David hurried to his office and phoned Annie. No answer. Then he called the motor pool. The man who had originally brought him his cart was off duty, but the one he reached told him,
"No, sir, no phone, nothing was left in there. We found the cart, but not you. And my boss was pretty mad until he traced you to medical services. You okay?"
"Fine."
"Need the cart?"
"No."
"Anything I can do for—"
But David had hung up.
He flipped open his computer and saw urgent messages flashing from the code words and numbers he knew belonged to his comrades in the Tribulation Force. He would get to those when he could, but for now, before the infernal meeting, he had to get his phone back and find out where Annie was. His watch read 21:35. He searched the GC database for personnel, medical, nursing, female under P. There it was. Pale Moon, Hannah L., room and extension 4223. A groggy hello greeted the fifth ring. Nurse Pale Moon?
Yeah? Who's this?
I am so sorry to be calling so late and sorry to wake you, but
Hasid?
Yes. Forgive me, but I have your phone. Oh, thank goodness. Is it on?
No, sir. I turned it off.
Now, are you coming to get it so I can get back to sleep?
Could I?
If you don't mind terribly, I gotta show you something anyway. What in the world? Was he being set up? Why would she be so willing to have him come and get it? And why did she take it in the first place? To be safe, he jumped back on the computer and fired up the bugging device that would record their conversation in the corridor outside her room. As he backed out of that program, he saw the blinking signals for his urgent messages again. Looked like Rayford and Albie had been desperately trying to reach him. He didn't have time to deal with them, but what if they had heard from Annie? He had to peek. The request stunned him. He was way late for helping Albie and Rayford in Colorado, but his fingers flew over the keyboard anyway. His head ached, his wound oozed, and he blinked furiously. He entered the numbers to override the peacekeeping security codes. Under his phony name as a high-level GC unit commander in New Babylon, he assigned Marcus Elbaz to Carpathia Memorial Airstrip in Colorado Springs. He also authorized him to temporarily appropriate a vehicle with which to take custody of an escapee from the Belgium Facility for Female Rehabilitation, currently incarcerated at a bunker on the north end of Pueblo. A few more keystrokes derived the exact coordinates of that facility and the name of the deputy director in charge, Pinkerton Stevens. Fortunately, Stevens was lower ranked than Deputy Commander Elbaz. David would work on name, rank, and serial number for Rayford later, hoping the two of them could bluff their way past the GC in the meantime. It was 21:50. Hannah Pale Moon was waiting, and he couldn't be late for the big meeting. Healthy and in shape, it would have been a challenge to get to her room, retrieve his phone, and get to Carpathia's office in time, but wounded as he was, he couldn't imagine it. He could phone Fortunato at the last minute and explain he would be a few minutes late, coming from his hospital bed. But neither did he want to miss any of that meeting. As he locked his door and strode quickly toward the elevator, he wobbled and had to grab the wall. "Catch your breath," he told himself. "Late is better than not there at all." "Give me my razor," Albie said. "It's going to be hard to pull this off if I'm out of regulation." "You'll be on the ground in less than a minute," Rayford said. "I have a co-pilot, do I not?" Rayford pulled Albie's electric razor from his bag and took over the landing as Albie shaved and straightened his tie. When the tower confirmed the landing, Albie responded, then whipped off the headphones and put on his uniform cap. When they disembarked, Rayford was struck again how the diminutive Middle Easterner seemed taller, more commanding. "I can point you to the refueling area so you can tank up before takeoff, Commander Elbaz." "You can't do it for me while I'm on assignment?" "Sorry, sir, we're short-handed. I know. Carry on." Rayford stayed a step behind Albie as they made their way to the offices, hoping that once David got him enlisted as a GC peacekeeper, he would give him an even higher rank. How could he supervise a man who outranked him in disguise? The officer at the desk saluted and said, "I told my chief you weren't in the computer, so you're on your own for ground transportation. If you give me your fuel and order number, however, I can clear you for that when..."
"Excuse me," Albie said.
"You'll have to refuel yourself, because I know all that.
I need a vehicle for an important assignment, and I need it now. You expect me to rent a car?"
"Sir, I'm just telling you what my chief said. Get him out here."
"He's a her, sir."
"I don't care if he's a gorilla. Get him or her out here." The airstrip chief appeared before the desk man buzzed her. She saluted but did not smile. "Judy Hamilton at your service, Commander?"
"Not enough at my service, I'm afraid."
"I can do only what I can do, sir, but I'm open to suggestions."
"Do you have a vehicle?"
"None available, sir."
"I need it for half a day tops."
"None, sir."
"You personally?"
"Me, sir?"
Albie sighed loudly through his nose. "You understand English, Hamilton. Do you personally have a vehicle?"
I have not been issued GC wheels, sir.
I didn't ask you that. How do you get to work?
I drive.
Then you must have a vehicle.
My own, yes, sir.
That would be what personal means, Judy. I will be borrowing your personal vehicle this afternoon, and the global community will be indebted to you. In fact, we will be indebted at the rate of 1 nick per mile.
She raised a brow.
The manual says half that, sir.
I'm aware of that, Albie said. I'll authorize it due to your cooperation.
No demerits for stupidity, sir?
Only for insubordination, Hamilton, which is one way I define sarcasm.
So you'll pay me a nick a mile for the use of my car?
You catch on quickly.
No.
No?
No, you'll not be using my car.
I beg your pardon, Hamilton.
I have a meeting in Monument in 2 hours, and C-25 has been open only a week, and not all lanes. I need to leave now.
And you believe your meeting takes precedence over that of a deputy commander?
It does today, sir, because of your attitude.
You are denying me the use of your car?
You catch on quickly.
Albie squinted at her, reddening.
You're going on report, Hamilton. You will be disciplined.
But surely not this afternoon, and you will be disciplined as well.
I? Albie said.
How long has it been since the resurrection of the potentate, yet you greeted neither my desk man nor me with a new phrase?
I have been busy and up for hours.
You don't know that we greet each other with He is risen to be responded to by He is risen indeed?
Of course. But, ma'am, I also need to know the exact location of the facility on the north end of Pueblo where
you don't have full orders, sir?
Unfortunately not.
Corporal, check the computer again. Let me see what we do have on Deputy Commander El Baz and whether we can add bluster and bullying to his profile.
Hamilton, I...
She silenced him with a hand.
Hey, the desk man said. This wasn't here before. Straight from the brass in New Babylon, look.
Hamilton peered and blanched at the screen. Rayford let out a breath. The woman cleared her throat.
It appears everything is in order, Commander. I would like to propose a truce.
I'm listening.
You're cleared for a vehicle, too, and we will find you one, though I will be happy to use the Jeep if you still care to use my car.
You would let me?
I will not only let you use the car, but I will also agree not to report your breach of protocol if you will keep between us your opinion of my insubordination.
Buck and Chloe left the baby in Leah's care while Tion and Chaim studied. The couple made their way to the basement of the tower where Buck had parked the Land Rover among many other vehicles.
We can be grateful this place had the ritzy clientele it did, Chloe said. Look at these rigs.
Buck had to smile at the difference between the filthy, banged-up Rover, which wasn't so old. He smacked a palm atop it, and it echoed throughout the parking garage. Old Bessie saw us through a lot, didn't she?
Chloe shook her head. She? You men and your penchant for attributing female characteristics to your cars.
Buck leaned back against a pillar and beckoned Chloe to him. He enveloped her.
Think about it, he said. I couldn't pay the car or women a higher compliment.
Keep digging. You'll need a backhoe in a minute.
Not if you think about it.
She leaned back and cocked her head, pointing to her temple.
Let's see if old Charlie and I can figure this out. Calling my brain by a man's name is the biggest compliment I can pay it and men.
Come on, Buck said. Think what that car's been through with us. It got us through traffic when the war broke out, kept you alive when you sailed it into a tree, no less, rode with me into a crevice in the earth and back out again, not to mention up over and through every obstacle.
You're right, she said. No man could have done that.
You and Charlie figure that out all by yourselves?
Yep. And want to know what else? I think a Humvee is the way to go this time.
We got one?
Two. Down around the corner near the luxury cars.
She pulled him to a darker area of the underground structure. All the spaces are numbered, and they coincide with the key pegboard in the attendant's shack. There's hardly a car in here with less than half a tank of gas, and most of them are full.
People must have been prepared.
Some were listening to the rumors of war, apparently.
Buck tapped her head.
Thank you, Charlie.
He surveyed the selection of vehicles, dozens of them, mostly new, and let out a low whistle.
When God blesses, he blesses.
But Chloe had grown quiet.
What you thinking? He said.
She pursed her lips and buried her hands in her jacket pockets. About what fun we would have had if we'd been lovers at any other time in history. He nodded. We wouldn't have been believers. Someone might have gotten to us. Look at us. This is the most fun I've had in ages. It's like we're in a free car dealership and it's our turn to pick. We've got a beautiful baby and a free sitter, and all we have to do is decide what model and color car we want. She rested against a white Hummer and Buck joined her. She shook her head. We're older than our years. Wounded, scarred, scared. It won't be long before our days will be spent looking for ways to just stay alive. I worry about you all the time. It's bad enough living now, but I couldn't go on without you. Yes, you could. I wouldn't want to. Would you, without me? Maybe I shouldn't ask. No, Chloe, I know what you mean. We have a cause, a mission, and everything seems crystal clear. But I wouldn't want to go on without you either. I would. I'd have to. For Kenny, for God, for the rest of the Force. Like Zeon says, for the kingdom. You'd have been the best thing that ever happened to me, even if you weren't my whole life. But you are. Let's watch out for each other. Keep each other alive. We've got only 3.5 years to go, but I want to make it. Don't you? Of course. She turned and held him tightly for a long minute. And they kissed fiercely. When David finally mint-stepped his way down the fourth floor of the employee residence tower, he found room 4223 open a crack, a sliver of light peeking out. He was about to knock when a dark hand, poking out the end of a quilted robe, thrust his phone out at him. "Thanks, ma'am," he said. "I've got to run." "Ma'am," Nurse Pale Moon said, "I can't be that much older than you, boy. How old are you?" "Why?" She opened the door and leaned wearily against the jamb. Her hair was up in huge rollers, and her eyes looked sleepy behind puffy cheeks. David was surprised how short she was. "I'm not even 30 yet," she said, "so quit with the ma'am, all right?" "Fair enough. Listen, I'm late for a meeting. I wanted to thank you, and I said I wanted to show you something." "So you did." "What? And why did you take my phone?" "Well, that's sort of what I wanted to show you." David didn't want to be rude, but what was this game? She just stood there, arms folded, gazing at him with raised brows. "Okay," he said. "What?" She didn't move. "Oh, brother," he thought. "She's not trying to make a move on me, please." He slipped the phone in his pocket and gestured with both palms raised. "Oh," she said. "You're in the dark." "I sure am." She straightened and flipped a switch just inside the door. The tiny light above her door illuminated them both. She matched his gesture, and he stopped breathing. "You've got to be kidding." Plain as the nose on her face, the mark was clear on her forehead. "Check it," she said. "I wouldn't blame you. I know yours is real. I rubbed it with alcohol." David looked up and down the hall, asked her to forgive him, licked his thumb, and pressed it against her forehead as she leaned into him. He looked both ways one more time and leaned down to embrace her briefly. "Sister," he whispered, "I am glad to see you. I didn't know we had anybody in medical." "I don't know of anyone else," she said, "but as soon as I saw your mark and knew your rank, I thought of your phone." "You're brilliant," he said. "You're welcome. I'll be back in touch." "I'm sure you will. And thanks, Nurse Hannah," she said. "Please, David." On his way back to the elevator, he checked his phone. There were several messages, none from Annie. He would visit the morgue only as a last resort. He speed-dialed the Supreme Commander's office and reached Sandra, the assistant Carpathia and Fortunato had shared. "Glad to hear you're up and about," she said. "They're expecting you. I'll tell them you'll be a few minutes." Assuming that because David had finally gotten Albie's clearance into the system, he might also have passed along the location of the Pueblo bunker, Rayford jogged to the fighter to grab Albie's computer on their way out. "This used to be an interstate," he said, driving Judy Hamilton's nondescript minivan south on C-25, "until everything got renamed for St. Nick." Albie was accessing data. "It's here," Albie said. "The interchanges and exits are still under construction, so watch for a hard left into Pueblo. I'll tell you from there." "Hmm,"
Pinkerton Stevens, there's a handle for you. The man we want to see there.
Heard of him? Albie shook his head.
Ask me tomorrow.
A few minutes later, they passed the Quonset hut-style building deep off a side road. Rayford said,
Question. Why not come in here with a GC Jeep? Complete the image.
Surprise. You told Miss Durham in no uncertain terms you were not coming, knowing they were listening. They're not expecting anyone. Let them wonder who's pulling in. I show up in uniform, outranking everyone. They don't recognize a civilian. They'll worry more about impressing us than making up a story. Anyway, I don't want to transport this woman in an open Jeep, do you?
Rayford shook his head. You really think we'll surprise them?
Only briefly. The gate guard will let them know Brass is coming.
Rayford popped a U-turn and headed for the entrance. The guard at the gate asked him to state his business.
Just chauffeuring the deputy commander here.
The guard stooped to get a look at Albie, then saluted.
An appointment with whom, sir?
Stevens, and I'm late if you don't mind.
Sign here, please.
Rayford signed Marvin Berry, and they were waved on. As they entered the front office, a woman at the desk was listening to a strange voice over the intercom. It was high-pitched and nasal, and Rayford couldn't tell if it came from a man or a woman.
A deputy commander to see me?
The voice said.
Yes, Mr. Stevens. I checked the name with the GC database, and the only Marvin Berry employed by us is not in peacekeeping. He's an elderly fisherman in Canada.
I smell a rat, the voice said.
So it's a man, but what's the matter with him? Rayford wondered.
One moment, sir, the woman said, standing when she noticed the deputy commander behind Rayford.
Is your name Berry?
Berry's my driver, Albie barked. Look up Elbaz on your computer. None of my family knows how to fish.
Mystery solved, Mr. Stevens, the woman announced over the intercom. The gate guard had the driver sign.
Incompetent,
Stevens' weird voice sang into the squawk box.
Send him in.
The guard?
The deputy commander.
She pointed to the first door on the left down a short hallway, but when Rayford moved to follow, she said,
Only the deputy commander, please.
He's with me, Albie said. I'll clear it with the boss.
Oh, I don't know.
I do, Albie said.
He stopped at the door and knocked.
Come in,
came the disembodied voice.
Come in, Albie repeated in a whisper. Is he going to be embarrassed when he realizes he didn't open the door to a superior officer?
Albie pushed the door open, stepped in, and hesitated, causing Rayford to bump into him.
Sorry, Rayford mumbled. He could not see Stevens, but he heard the whine of an electric motor.
Forgive the lack of protocol,
came the voice as Stevens' wheelchair rolled into view. Rayford was taken aback. The man had one leg, the other a stump just above the knee. His right hand had small protrusions in place of fingers, and the other hand, the whole, had clearly suffered severe burns.
I'd stand, but then I can't.
Understood, Albie said, hesitantly shaking the man's partial hand.
Rayford did the same, and they followed Stevens's gesture to two chairs that filled the small office.
What was it about the face?
Stevens's neck was permanently red and scarred, as were his cheekbones and ears. He was clearly wearing a toupee. Except for the lips, the middle of his face, chin, nose, eye sockets, and the center of his forehead seemed all of one piece, the color of a plastic hearing aid.
Don't know you, Albaz, Stevens said, almost like a man with no tongue or no nose. You, Berry, you look familiar. You GC?
No, sir. I'm here on business, Albie said. I don't have a hard copy of my orders, but excuse me, Deputy Commander, but I'll get to you. You got a minute?
Well, sure, but
just give me a minute.
I mean, I know you outrank me and all, but unless you're in an unusual hurry, bear with me. Your story checks out. I'll give you all the help I can on whatever you need. Now, Berry, were you ever GC?
Rayford, disconcerted by the wasted body and the voice, hesitated.
No, sir. Not peacekeeping, anyway.
But something.
I didn't mean to say that.
But you did. You were GC connected some way, weren't you? You look familiar. I know you, or of you, or I'll bet I know a friend of yours.
Albie gave Rayford a look, and Rayford quit talking. Regardless of the question, Rayford merely stared at the man, racking his brain. Where would he have run into a Pinkerton Stevens, and how could he forget him if he had?
I was a whole man then, Mr. Barry, if that's your real name.
Rayford grew more uncomfortable by the second. Had they been set up? Would he ever get out of here? And what of Hattie? Albie seemed to have stiffened and was no more comfortable than he. Stevens cocked his head for one more lingering glance at Rayford, then turned to Albie.
Now then, Deputy Commander Elbaz, what might be your business with me?
I've been assigned to take custody of your prisoner, sir.
And who told you I had a prisoner?
Top brass, sir. Said the subject was uncooperative, that some plan or mission failed, and that we were to return her to Buffer.
Buffer? What's that?
You know what that is, Stevens, if you are who you say you are.
Doesn't make sense that half a man would be in the leadership role in the GC?
Stevens said. I didn't say that.
But it doesn't add up, does it?
Can't say it does.
Never saw another like me in the ranks, have you, Elbaz?
No, sir, I haven't.
Well, I'm legit, whether you like it or not, and you're going to have to deal with me.
Happy to, sir. And when you check me out, you'll see that everything is in order.
And did I say I was housing a prisoner here, Deputy Commander?
No, sir, but I know you are.
You know I am?
Yes, sir.
Buffer is a female rehab facility, sir. Were you under the impression I had a female incarcerated here?
Albie nodded.
Does this look like a detention center to you?
They take different forms during different times.
Indeed they do. Is there a reason, sir, why you did not greet me with the new protocol?
I've been having trouble remembering that, Mr. Stevens.
Indeed. Do you realize, sir, that you have a smudge on your forehead?
Albie jerked. Rayford felt a chill. A GC peacekeeper could see Albie's mark? Things tumbled into place so fast that Rayford could barely keep up. How much had been compromised? Albie knew everything.
I do, Albie said innocently. He swiped at his forehead with his palm.
There, that's better, Stephen said.
Albie slowly moved his hand until it rested on his sidearm. If only Rayford had one.
Gentlemen, Stevens enunciated carefully past his awful sound, if you'll do me the kindness of following me, I'd like us to start over in a new room. This time we'll begin with the proper protocol. What do you say?
He rolled past Rayford and Albie, reached for the door, swung it open, and sped through before it slammed on him. Albie rose and grabbed it, and Rayford followed him down the hall. Albie unsnapped the strap that held the 9mm in its holster. Rayford wondered if he had time to peel off and get out the front door to the van before Albie knew he was gone. He hesitated, hoping the whir of the chair would cover him if he made the decision. But Albie turned and motioned Rayford to walk in front of him, behind the fast-moving chair. Even if he could escape, Hattie was history. He had no choice but to stay and play it out. Chapter 5. Buck settled on the white Hummer, confirmed it had a full tank, checked the tires, found the keys, checked the engine, and fired it up. "What shall we name her?" Chloe said. "This is a big old muscle car," he said. "It's got Chloe written all over it." It would be hours before dark, and they would be in touch with Zeke frequently to discover what he knew about the positioning of the GC stakeout. They were looking for rebels who gassed up at his dad's station, not expecting Zeke Jr. to even be there. But could Buck get him out of there without their seeing? Kenny was down for a nap, and Leah was reading when they returned. "Tsion said you could join him and Chaim," she said, "and Chloe was going to involve me in the co-op stuff." "I've got to start communicating with everyone," Chloe said, setting up her computer as Leah pulled up a chair. Buck moved up one floor to Tsion's hideaway. What a spot he had set up for himself. In a room just big enough for a U-shaped desk, Tsion had what amounted to a cockpit, where he was within arm's length of whatever he needed. With his computer before him and his commentaries and Bible on a ledge above, he was ready. Buck was struck by how few books he had brought with him, but Dr. Benjuda explained that most of what he needed had been scanned onto his massive hard drive. Chaim sat in a comfortable chair, looking less than comfortable. He had been hurt worse than Buck in the plane crash, yet he sat weeping tears of apparent joy as Tzion rushed to teach him.
"Much of this you have heard from your youth, Chaim," the rabbi said. "But now that God has opened your eyes and you know Jesus is the Messiah, you will be amazed at how it all comes together for you and makes sense."
Chaim rocked and wept and nodded.
"I see," he said over and over. "I see."
Buck sat transfixed, hearing in a gush much of what he had learned over the past 3+ years from Tzion's daily cyber messages. At times, the rabbi himself would be overcome and have to stop and exult.
"Chaim, you don't know how we prayed for you, again and again, that God would open your eyes. Do you need a break, my brother?"
Chaim shook his head but held up a hand, trying to make himself understood despite the wired shut jaw.
"God is opening my eyes to so many things," he managed. "Cameron, come close. I must ask you something."
Buck looked at Tzion, who nodded, and he pulled his chair closer to Chaim's.
"I always wondered why you had not come to Nikolai's first meeting with his new leadership team at United Nations, remember?"
"Of course."
"Forgive me for spitting on you, Cameron, but I cannot speak another way just now."
"Don't give it a second thought."
"I could not fathom it. The privilege of a lifetime, the opportunity no self-respecting journalist could miss. You were invited. I invited you. You said you would come, and yet you did not. It was the talk of New York. You were demoted because of it. Why? Why did you not come?"
"I was there, Chaim."
"No one saw you there. Nikolai was disappointed, enraged. Everyone asked about you. Your boss, what was his name?"
"Steve Plank."
"Mr. Plank could not believe it. Hattie Durham was there. You were the one who introduced her to Carpathia, and yet you were not there when she expected you."
"I was there, Chaim."
"I was there too, Cameron. Your place at the table was empty."
Buck was about to say again that he was there, but he suddenly realized what was happening and why Chaim would bring this up again after so long. "Your eyes truly are being opened, aren't they, Chaim?" The old man put a quivering hand on Buck's knee.
"I could not understand it. It made no sense. Jonathan Stonegal had embarrassed Nikolai by going after you. Nikolai shamed him into committing suicide, and he killed Joshua Todd Guthrie in the process."
Buck wanted to say he had seen it, and that was not the way it had happened, but he waited.
"None of it made sense," Rosenzweig whined. "None of it, but the eyes don't lie. Stonegal grabbed the gun from the security guard, shot himself and his colleague with him."
"No, Chaim," Buck whispered, "the eyes don't lie. But the Antichrist does." Rosenzweig began to shiver until his whole body shook. He pressed his hands against his tender face to stop the quivering of his lips.
"Why were you not there, Cameron?"
"Why would I not have been there, sir? What could have kept me away?"
"I cannot imagine."
"Neither could I."
"Then why? Why?"
Buck did not respond. He had quit trying to convince the old man. "I was assigned to be there. My boss expected me to go."
"Yes, yes."
It was the mother of all cover stories for the largest circulation magazine in history. It was the apex of my career. Would I have thrown that away? Rosenzweig shook his head, tears falling, hands trembling.
"You would not."
"Of course I wouldn't. Who would?"
"Maybe you had come to believe Nikolai was Antichrist and you didn't want to be exposed to him?"
"By then I knew, yes, or thought I did. I would not have gone in there without the protection of God."
"And you did not have it?"
"I had it."
"And so why not go? You would have been the only one there with God's hand upon you."
Buck merely nodded. Rosenzweig's eyes cleared, and it appeared he was studying something 1,000 miles away. His pupils darted back and forth.
"You were there."
"Yes, I was."
"You were there, weren't you, Cameron?"
I was, sir.
And you saw it all?
I saw everything.
But you did not see what the rest of us saw.
I saw what really happened. I saw the truth. Chaim's hands fluttered beside his head, and through clenched teeth he described what he had once seen and what he now saw anew.
Nikolai! Nikolai murdered those men. He made Stonegal kneel before him, stuck the weapon in the man's ear, and killed the both of them with one shot.
That's what happened.
But Nikolai told us what we had seen, told us what we would remember, and our perception became our reality.
Chaim turned around and knelt, resting his fragile head in his hands, elbows on the seat of his chair.
Oh God, oh God, he prayed, open my eyes. Help me to always see the truth, your truth. Don't let me be led by a madman, deceived by a liar. Thank you, Jehovah God.
Slowly he stood and embraced Buck, then turned to face Tzion.
Truly Nikolai is Antichrist, he said. He must be stopped. I want to do whatever I have to do.
Tzion smiled ruefully.
May I remind you that you already tried? I certainly did, but not for the reasons I would try today.
If you think you know the depths of the depravity of the man, Tzion said, wait till we get to what he has in mind for God's chosen people. Chaim sat and reached for a pad of paper.
Skip to that, Tzion, please.
In due time, my friend. Just a few thousand more years to go. Despite his pain, David was rested. He could have used more, but he had slept the sleep of the drugged, and his mind, at least, felt refreshed. Unfortunately, that made it hard for him to separate his dread over Annie from his wariness over the indwelt Carpathia. He had been in the presence of evil many times, but never in the company of Satan himself. He breathed a prayer for Annie, thanks for Nurse Pale Moon, for Tzion, who had taught him that Satan, though infinitely more powerful than any human, was no match for the Lord God. He is not omniscient, Tzion had taught, not omnipresent. Deceiving, persuasive, controlling, beguiling, possessive, oppressive, yes, but greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. They're waiting for you, Sandra told him. Apparently the risen potentate did not want you to miss a thing. Well, good then. And with your arrival, I leave. And that's good, too. Long day. You and me both. Feeling all right? Heard you took a tumble. Better. Good night, Director Hasid. And, oh yes, he is risen. David stared at her and was struck by the plainness of her forehead compared to that of the beautiful dark sister he had just met. He is risen indeed, he said, meaning just what he said. He knocked and entered and was dazed when not only Carpathia and Fortunato stood, but all the other managers too.
My beloved David, Carpathia began, how good that you are up to joining us.
Thank you, David said, as Intelligence Director Jim Hickman pushed out a chair for him.
Yes, Hickman said, how good it is.
He beamed, peeking at Carpathia as if to see whether he had pleased the boss. The potentate pursed his lips and squinted, ignoring Hickman. To David, it appeared purposeful. Hickman was Fortunato's choice, and Carpathia had scarcely hidden his opinion of the man as a buffoon. The team of 24 plus Nikolai and Leon sat around a huge mahogany table in Nikolai's office, the first time David had been there for this size of a meeting. David felt a dark foreboding as he sat, and was shaken to see a well-worn Bible on the table in front of Nikolai. Everyone else sat when David did, but Carpathia remained standing. The man seemed energized, his breath coming quickly in great gasps that whistled through his teeth. It was as if he were a football player caged in the locker room before kickoff of a championship game.
"Gentlemen and ladies," he began, "I have a new lease on life."
The room exploded with laughter, and when it waned, Nikolai was still laughing.
"Trust me, there is nothing like waking from the dead."
The others nodded and smiled. David was aware of Security Chief Walter Moon's gaze, so he offered a cursory nod.
"Oh, I was dead, people, lest anyone wonder."
They shook their heads.
"Mr. Fortunato, we should publish photographs from the autopsy, the coroner's report, the rising itself. There will always be skeptics, but anyone who was there knows the truth."
"We know," several said. David felt evil emanating so pervasively from Carpathia that he sat rigid and worried he might faint. Suddenly Nikolai faced him.
"Director Hasid, you were there?"
"I was, sir."
"You had a good view?"
"Perfect, sir."
"You saw me rise from the dead?"
"I'll never deny it."
Carpathia chuckled warmly. He strode to his desk and stood behind the huge stuffed red leather chair. He caressed it, then massaged it deeply.
"It is as if I am seeing this for the first time," he said to 24 pairs of admiring eyes. "Leon, what is directly above my office?"
"Why, nothing, sir. We're on 18, the top floor."
"No utility room, no elevator maintenance area?"
"Nothing, sir."
"I want more room, Leon. Are you taking notes?"
"Yes, sir. What do you have so far?"
"Autopsy photos, coroner's report, the rising. Add the expansion of my office. I want it twice as high, with a transparent ceiling that exposes me to the heavens."
"Consider it done, Excellency."
"How soon?" Carpathia said.
"Who would know that?"
Fortunato pointed at the construction director, who waved a tentative hand.
"Yes, sir," Nikolai pressed. "And may I assume this would be top priority?"
"You bet your life," the man said, and Carpathia nearly collapsed with laughter.
"Let me tell you something, Director. I know you must displace me for a few days because of the mess it will be to raise and raise this ceiling. But I want this done as fast as humanly possible. And do you know why?"
"I have an idea, sir."
"Do you?" The man nodded. "By all means, let us hear it."
"Because I don't believe you are human anymore, and you could do it faster than my team on its best day?"
"Only God bestows such wisdom, Director."
"I believe I am in his presence, Potentate."
Nikolai smiled.
"I believe you are, too."
He turned and gestured to all.
"When I lay there dead for 3 days, my spirit was so strong and powerful that I knew my time would come. When death had enjoyed victory over me long enough, I willed myself to live again. I raised myself, people. I raised myself back to life."
A murmur filled the room as the men and women approved aloud and pressed their hands together as if praying to him or worshipping him. Nikolai picked up the Bible in what seemed to David a loving manner.
"You may wonder what this is doing here," he said.
He opened it and let it plop spine first onto the table.
"This is the playbook of those who oppose me. This is the holy book of those who do not recognize me and who will not, despite what they saw with their own eyes."
He slammed a fist onto the book.
"This holds the lies about the chosen people of God, and the supreme lie, that there is one above me."
His team, save one, murmured disapproval. Carpathia stood back from the end of the table and folded his arms, legs spread.
"We shall use their very blueprint to bring them to their knees. The Jews, who worship their coming Messiah in their own holy land, in their beloved city where they deign slay me. I shall return there triumphant, and they will have one opportunity to repent and see the light.
and the Judahites, who believe Messiah already came and went, who believe Jesus is their Savior, and whom I see nowhere, do you, also trace their heritage to Jerusalem. If they want to see the true and living God, let them journey there, for that is where I shall soon be. If the sacred temple is the residence of the Most High God, then the Most High God shall reside there, high on the throne. In the city where they slew me, they shall see me, high and lifted up.
Many directors raised fists of victory and encouragement.
Now, some plans. As I have left no doubt in any thinking person's mind about who I am, I no longer feel the need for a buffer between my team and me. While my dear comrade, Supreme Commander Leon Fortunato, has ably assisted me since first I came to power, I have need of him now in another crucial role, one he has already accepted with enthusiasm. What was once nobly attempted and ultimately failed shall now be consummated in success and victory. The Enigma Babylon One World Faith failed because, despite its lofty goal of unifying the world's religions, it worshipped no god but itself. It was devoted to unity, yet that was never achieved. Its god was nebulous and impersonal. But with Leon Fortunato as Most High Reverend Father of Carpathianism, the devout of the world finally have a personal God whose might and power and glory have been demonstrated in the raising of himself from the dead.
Many applauded, and Carpathia motioned to Leon to rise and speak as he himself backed away but remained standing.
I am deeply humbled by this assignment, Leon said, moving to Nikolai, dropping to his knees and kissing the potentate's hands. He rose and moved back to the head of the table. Let me clarify, not that His Excellency needs any help from a mere mortal, that the very name of the new religion was my idea. It was no stroke of brilliance. What else could we call a faith in which the object of our worship is His Excellency? The outpouring of emotion from the citizens this very day spurred the idea that we should reproduce the image of His Excellency, the great statue, and erect it in all the major cities throughout the world. Plans have already been sent out, and each city is required to have the image constructed. They will be only a quarter of the size of the original, which, as you know, was four times life size. It doesn't take a scientist to figure out then that the replicas will be exactly life size. While our beloved potentate lay dead, he imbued me with power to call fire from the sky to kill those who would oppose him. He blessed me with the power to give speech to the statue so we could hear his own heart. This confirmed in me the desire to serve him as my god for the rest of my days, and I shall do that for as long as Nikolai Carpathia gives me breath.
Thank you, my beloved servant, Nikolai said as Leon sat. Now, blessed comrades, I have written assignments for one and all. These were prepared just before my demise, and will now make more sense than ever to you. First, one of my oldest and dearest friends, a woman closer to me than a relative, shall explain something to you. Miss Ivins, if you would come.
Viv Ivins, prim and proper, her gray hair piled atop her head, made her way to the head of the table and embraced Nikolai. As she passed out file folders with each director's name inscribed on them, Nikolai said, "Many of you know that Miss Ivins helped raise me. Indeed, for many years I believed she was my aunt. We were that close. She has been working on a project that will help me put in place certain unfortunately necessary controls on the citizenry. Most people are devoted to me, we know that. Many who were not, or who were undecided, are now decidedly with us, and you will agree for good reason. But there are those factions, primarily the two that I have already mentioned, who are not loyal.
Perhaps now they have seen the error of their ways and will henceforth be loyal. If so, they will have no trouble with the safeguards I feel must be initiated. I am asking those loyal to the global community, specifically to me and to the unified faith, to willingly bear a mark of loyalty.
Walter Moon stood. Sir, I beg of you, allow me to be the first to bear your mark.
Let us not get ahead of ourselves, brother, Nikolai said. You may just get your wish, and while I am touched by your sentiment, how do you know that I will not brand you with an iron like a head of cattle?
Moon spread his hands on the table and bowed his head.
As you, my lord, are my witness, I would endure it and bear it with endless pride.
My, my, Nikolai said. If Director Moon's sentiment is shared by the populace, we shall need no enforcement measure, shall we?
David peeked at his packet and fanned the pages until his eye fell on a startling word.
Guillotines? He said aloud before he could stop himself.
Now we are ahead of ourselves, Nikolai said. Needless to say, such would be a last resort, and I pray will never be needed. I would gladly offer my head, Moon rhapsodized, if I should be so foolish as to deny my lord.
Nikolai turned to David.
You are responsible for technical purchasing, correct?
David nodded.
I do not imagine we have an adequate supply of immediate